Good afternoon and happy New Year's, everybody. Man, here I am back with my good friend Chancey Lewis, and we must apologize because it has been a while since we talked to you last. And to be honest, we were just sitting here discussing things, and we don't even honestly remember what our last topic was. We think maybe habitat restoration or something, but it's been a while, and we apologize.
Yeah, no, afternoon, Brad, and yeah, happy New Year. I hope everybody's enjoying their 2025 so far. But yeah, it's been quite a while since we last sat down here.
Man, 2025, me and Chancey are going to be, we're glad to be back with you. We apologize again for the long wait, and I think you're going to really enjoy today's topic.
I hope so. This ought to be a really interesting one. It's something I know a lot of landowners are interested in, and even if you know a lot about feral hogs, which is what our topic's going to be, there's a lot of stuff that we hope to cover and even bring some guests in that'll broaden all of our horizons, I believe.
Well, definitely mine. I know a thing or two about hunting hogs that Chancey's taught me through the past. We've spent many hours running through the woods chasing after them growing up. Come to think of it, you know, I mean, when we were little kids, I don't even remember there hardly being any in our area, to be honest with you.
When we were little bitty? No, yes. There wasn't any in the Blackland. There was a few, I guess, back in the early 90s over in the Post Oaks. But no, in the Blackland where we grew up, there were no hogs. Yeah, little deer, too, though, in the 80s.
Like Chancey said, growing up, we didn't have hardly any hogs out there. Of course, as you know from past conversations, well, I grew up in the Blacklands out there with Chancey, and we farmed a lot of corn, a lot of cotton and milo, different things. And I don't remember there ever being a broken over corn stalk or a milo stalk when we were little kids. And then, man, all of a sudden around, gosh, I guess what, probably 30 years ago, yeah, they really started to hit.
Seems the mid-90s, I think they really started expanding.
I mean, I'd never forget whenever they first started to get here and the corn was knocked down and the milo was knocked down. And it got so bad to where you would bale hay grazer bales up and stack them, you know, in the fields to prepare to feed that winter. Hogs would come through and they would rip every bit of the net wrap off, and you'd have 200 or 300 round bales of hay out there. Of course, they were going after the seeds, I guess, you know, in the hay grazer, and they would completely destroy 200 or 300 rolls of hay just scattered out, just looking for that little bit of grain and stuff that was inside.
It's unbelievable. I've seen them go into hay traps and absolutely annihilate it, you know. And a lot of times at first, and back in the early 90s, the landowners, whether you're a range guy or a farmer, didn't really know what they were seeing, you know. Like, dang, something's digging up the pasture, something's, you know, it's like they were just that new to many of us. They were very damaging, extremely damaging, and, oh, heck, we're going to get to some control methods and where we are now as far as eradication and whatever happened, but I guess before that, we need to talk about a little bit about the history of pigs and history and feral hogs and some biology and some things like that, because they affect all of us. If you own land and you're a landowner in Texas, more than likely you have dealt with feral hogs.
And it's kind of one of those things where half the people like them and half the people don't like them. Yes. You're a hunter. You know, I've had conversations, you know, being a farmer, I've had conversations with some of the people that I've hunted with over the years who, you know, are all in thermal hunting and different things and trapping, and they love hogs.
Yeah.
You know, and I would be, you know, I'd call them out to say, hey, man, come on, let's see if we can get rid of these hogs that are, you know, that are tearing up this cornfield in this area over here, you know, and we'll get into a debate over, man, I think poison's a great idea. And they'll be like, no, it's not either. It's the end of the world kind of thing, you know. Two very different viewpoints, you know, depending on what your interests are.
They certainly are a PR problem, for sure, depending on where the amount of damage. I don't even know what it was now. And a lot of the stuff that I'm going on, as far as I know, the history and the biology of the hogs haven't changed in the last 16 years. So a lot of this stuff is old slides that I put together, y'all, when I worked for Extension and dealt strictly with feral hogs. Back then, I think the last number I saw was like they do $52 million worth of damage in Texas alone. And that was, you know, 15, 16 years ago. I'm sure it's much more now with crops and even like, they're in urban areas, they're in towns. Even then, I was seeing, you know, pictures of damage in lawns in suburban areas. You know, they're just about everywhere. They're nearly in every county. I think El Paso County, there's a few of them. I think they haven't been found or documented as of 2022 in El Paso County, but it's just a matter of time, if they're not there already, that they're in every single county in Texas. And we'll get to that here in a little bit.
But, well, I mean, you said a while ago, how many millions of years do they date back, actually?
I think the domestic hogs started 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, is what they say. Like, if you go and, you know, I wasn't alive 5,000 or 7,000 years ago, and I know no scientist was either, but they've dated them back to that was when they were domesticated.
That was when we first domesticated them.
From
okay,
the
that's
true
what it was.
Wild boar. It's kind of like every domestic hog, every breed of hog, it's like every breed of dog is originally from a wolf. Well, every breed of hog is originally from the true European wild boar. You know, I guess we'll just get into it. So the wild boars and the feral hogs, what we call feral hogs, they're all members of the same family. And that family is the family Suidae. And they include the feral hogs and they include the European wild boars and all their crosses. So they can interbreed. You know, they may be different species where it's a wild boar European, what we call a Russian hog is, you know, Suscrofa, whereas domestic pig, depending on which taxonomist you talk to, if he's a lumper or a splitter, he'll call him Suscrofa or Suscrofa domesticus or Sus domesticus, depending on who it is. To just start with the wild boar, well, the Eurasian wild boar, what we call Russian or some people call Russian wild hogs, they're native to the Ural Mountains in Russia and native to Poland and Germany. And I think, I'm not positive on that. I want to say I think they're native to France as well, but maybe they just occur in France. But where they're native to, I know they're native to those three areas. And as far as in America, the first pure blood Russian boars were imported from Germany in 1890 by a gentleman named Austin Corbin. And they were released into a 20,000 acre enclosure in Sullivan County, New Hampshire. And most of these early releases in the late 1800s and what we're going to talk to, they were mainly done for hunting and as a food source.
You know, that's a fair, and I mean, when you're speaking history, that's pretty recent.
Yeah, 1890, yeah. So you think, you know, he brought some hogs, some purebred Russian, no joke, wild boar hogs and dropped them off in New Hampshire.
I wonder what kind of paperwork he had to fill out to do that, Chancey.
Probably none. I bet he just had 20,000 acres. He's like, hey, man, I want to hunt some hogs in here. So
brought them on over and let them loose.
Yeah. And so, like, if you think about it, there was additional stockings. And so in 1900, they were released into the Adirondack Mountains of New York. Now, these are true Russian hogs.
All in the Northeast.
Yeah, and in the 1912, they were introduced into the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee and North Carolina. 1990, they were brought to Texas. The true wild boars were released in Aransas County in 1919 in Texas.
Well, there you go. That's when they started to show up around here.
In 1919?
Oh, so I thought you said 1990.
No, 1919. Yeah.
Yeah, say, wow, that was fast.
Yeah. But no, it's 1919. They put them down in Aransas County, and I'm sure same thing for hunting.
Who moved them down there at that time? Was it a private individual? Or
I'm guessing so. It wasn't anything the state was doing or anything. You know, I mean, I'm sure it was game breeders, and that was before high fences were getting big and a lot of things. But I think that it was just people kind of bring them. They looked at them as a good food source. You know, we didn't know much about their ecological damage they could do. We also didn't know, it's one thing, the true Russian wild boar isn't that big of a problem. It's the problem that we've created, which is the feral hog, which is what we're going to get into, which is what's created the nightmare. I mean, we really have created our own nightmare, which we'll get into here shortly. But just to finish up the stockings, in 1925, they were introduced into Monterey County, California. Then in 1939, Calhoun County, Texas. And in the 1940s, they were brought to San Antonio area and released into Bear County, Texas.
In 1940s?
In the 1940s. And that's your true blue Russian wild Eurasian wild boar.
All for hunting purposes?
From my understanding, that was the main. Now, I'm sure some people were using them maybe as a food source or whatever, but I don't think so. I think the true blue, it was a hunting thing. I may be wrong on that, but I can't see any other reason why they would be released in those areas, in those particular places, other than, you know, as a game animal.
So within 50 years, they were spread all the way from New Hampshire to San Antonio.
Well, not all. They didn't, as far as I know, they weren't released in Georgia or Florida.
I'm sorry. Yeah, in Texas.
They were in kind of discreet areas there. But that was the Eurasian wild boar. Now, their biology, even though they're the same species, they have a different fecundity and a different biology as the little nightmare we created, the feral hog, which we'll get into. And before we can really talk about the feral hogs, which are feral just means wild, they've gone wild, we need to talk about domestic hogs in Texas. Domestic hogs have been, you know, throughout their part of our history, the United States history forever. I mean, it goes way back to scalding hogs to, you know, hogs got, all of our ancestors depended on hogs 100% to survive through the winters, especially if you were from the east, like in Kentucky and, you know, Tennessee. I mean, everybody, hogs was very, very important to the lifestyle of all of our ancestors. But specifically in Texas, domestic hogs, so not Eurasian wild boars, domestic hogs, they were brought to Texas in the mid-1500s by De Soto. He introduced domestic pigs to Texas. In 1565, Spanish colonists drove swine north across the Rio Grande to avoid Indians. So basically, you had Spanish colonists down there, and Indians get after them, and they had domestic animals to eat and survive, you know, and they drove them north into Texas as well, because they didn't want Indians to kill them and kill them as well. They were just basically escaping.
Well, you know, I mean, they actually probably made a really good food source, being as though they have a relatively, you know, large number of babies.
Yeah.
And they feed themselves well. You know, I mean, it,
you make lard out of them. You can preserve things out of them. You can smoke them. You can smoke the meat. I mean, you make soap out of them. I mean, we were used them for everything.
I think they've got the highest dressing percentage out of all livestock, don't they? At like 60. Man, I'm going to lie if I say
that. I have no idea.
It seemed like I heard the meat science class 30 years ago that it was like 65 or 67%, something like that.
Yeah,
that you actually get, you know, useful stuff out of every hog that you butcher. If I'm going to bring livestock over with me to feed my family, that's where I'll probably start at.
Well, yeah, especially with domestic hogs, because it can have so much. And like I said, we'll get into their gestation and the reproduction here in a bit, but absolutely, I mean, we used them for everything. They were very, very important historically. 1670, hogs brought north to Texas as a food source for the missions. So when we were in the 1600s, had all the missions going on in Texas, they were a food source there. In 1685, LaSalle brought hogs to the coast when he came. You know, so LaSalle, so this is, you know, 1685, I'm sorry, 185 years after De Soto first brought them. And then from the 1850s to the 1950s, basically 100 years, domestic swine were allowed to free range across West, Central, and South Texas. If think about your old days of watching Old Yeller, you know, and what was he doing? You got your hog marking done. You know, we just let our hogs run wild. Now, I know Old Yeller was filmed in California, I believe, but the history holds true. We did that. And so farmers just let their hogs free range, and then every now and then they'd go mark them and get them, you know, and work them. That happened for 100 years. So.
Well, I mean, in 1850, there were no hog pens.
No, and I don't even know. I doubt there was probably 1860s or something when barbed wire first started getting strong. But, I mean, hogs go right through barbed wire.
That's
so you
right.
Know that ain't no problem. And I seriously doubt there was any net wire. So
it took a pretty good while to come up with a fence worthy of holding hogs in.
Yeah, and still difficult to do. And you still better maintain it. So let's just, okay, so there's our Eurasian wild boar. There's our domestic pigs. But let's talk about feral hogs. And feral hogs are, in my opinion, they're a conglomeration of all of domestics, maybe with a little bit of wild, mostly domestics that have gone wild, been free. And I forget, I'm not a geneticist, but I remember, like, they've done some science where if you can take a domestic pig and just let it go back to the wild, they can revert back to their old characteristics relatively quick. But some of their biology and some of the descriptions of them is feral hogs are just smaller, leaner, and more muscular than domestic pigs. The average weights are between 110 and 130 pounds. That's the average. Now, I'm not saying you can't get bigger. There's always, you hear about somebody that shot a 250 or even a 300. 300-pound hogs are very rare. I've killed a lot of them, and you rarely, rarely see a 300. I've weighed a lot of them, and you think one that goes 300, he might only go 220 or 240. So they can look bigger than they think, in my opinion. But they are out there. I have seen them.
There's, well, what exact were the domestic hog and the Russian hogs about the same size?
No, I think the Russian, if you look at a true Russian boar and a big great boar, they just look, they almost look something like from the Paleolithic time to me. I mean, they remind me of like something, one of the megafaunas. I mean, they really are an impressive looking individual. Big old tushes and like a big old head and pointy ears. I mean, they're really an impressive animal to look at. And some of our great big feral hogs look like that too, you know. To me, like, it's just a genetic roll of the dice, you know. Some, because you see feral hogs, they can come in all colors. They just, you know, they can be black and white and red. Some of them look like Duroc. Some of them are just black. Sometimes they have spotted babies, but whereas the true Eurasian wild boar, it always has striped babies, little striped babies to keep them cryptic and hide. And so, like, if you see feral hogs with striped babies, that tells you, you know, those are of a little bit more wilder genes in them. And I just think it's just the genetic roll of the dice, whereas one of them may throw spots, it's got more domestic. And so we've kind of created this monster of having a wild hog, feral hog, but it's got the reproductive capacity of a domestic pig.
Yeah, you know, more and more now, I'll see white hogs with black spots on them. Yeah. They're mostly white.
Yeah, look like Hampshire. I've seen some that look like Hampshire.
They do, you know? Yes. You can't hardly keep those. I mean, they can't hardly hide too well.
No, no. But, you know, then sometimes in the same sounder, you'll see some that look more wild. More with their biology, they have four continually growing canine teeth. These teeth can reach up to 5 inches. The upper canine teeth are called whitters or grinders, and they function as whetstones to sharpen the lower teeth and keep them hard, what we call tushes or tusks. So, you know, if you're a hog hunter and you've ever run dogs and all that stuff, you know all about what I'm talking about.
And so the top ones are to sharpen the bottom ones.
Yeah, but they can cut, too. There are weapons, too. They can be used in fighting, you know, courtship battles between males. That's why the males have such big, heavy shields on their shoulders, because if you've ever watched hogs fight, they stand side by side and hook each other into that shoulder and into their neck, and they will really get after it if you've ever watched two big boars get after it.
Yeah, me and you have seen several dogs cut open by
absolutely. I mean, not only can they cut them good, they can kill them too. You know, to me, it's always those little sharp ones that stick straight out were the worst. But the boars, they also, what we just talked about, they develop a thick plaque of skin and tissue on the shoulder referred to as a shield. It's influenced by the amount of testosterone level, the age, how old the boar is, and also fighting, just scar tissue will make it thicker. But on those real big ones, when you go to skin them, I mean, that thing can be up to 2 inches thick. So, I mean, it'll stop a small caliber bullet. It really will. I mean, you shoot one square in the shoulder, a big boar, it's a thick, thick, hard, you know what I'm talking about if you've ever skint one.
Almost enough to stop a 223?
If you hit him square a big, big one, it ain't going to go through him. You know, you better lung punch him if he's really big. But, you know, if you have a big 30 caliber or something, yeah, you can probably punch him right in the shoulder and it's going to kill him, even a big hole. But their sight's generally poor, but it's better than you think. We give them credit, like we don't credit them enough. They can actually see better than what most people give them credit for. Their hearing is excellent, and their smell is absolutely exceptional. They can smell, and if you've ever pressured hogs, if you've ever hunted hogs, you think a group of does can get wild when you go to killing them. You go to killing feral hogs, and you see how smart and how hard they are to kill. Once they realize they're on the menu, they can get very, very, very sneaky and very, very smart and learn how to avoid hunters better than a buck, in my opinion.
I didn't realize they were that intelligent.
Yes, highly intelligent. I've heard, I don't know, people have trained pigs. I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that they're similar to a dog as far as intelligence. Like, you can potty train them. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, I ain't gonna let no hog in my house, but I've heard that you can.
Well, now might be the time to tell a story about your hog that you raised that time.
Well, which one?
What was his name? I forget what his name was.
I had one from Utopia. Yeah, no. So yeah, that's a terrible story. Yeah, raised one from a piglet, a little feral hog that we caught in Utopia when I was kid hunting, and it was a little orange and black rascal, and I named him Rudy Rooter.
That was his name, Rudy Rooter.
Yeah,
yes,
Rudy Rooter. Yeah, and then I got tired of feeding Rudy Rooter when I got back to high school.
He was old, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was old hog. Yeah.
You had him for a long time.
Yeah, over 10 years. Probably.
I thought so.
Yeah, I got him when I was probably 13 or 14. And mm-hmm. I don't know, I was probably 12, and I got rid of him, I think, when I was a senior, you know.
I remember when you sold him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't forget that big wealth, the big profits you made off of that one.
Yeah, $7. The sale board, he brought $7.
Did it even pay the commission, or that was after commission?
I think that was after commission, yeah. Rudy Rooter brought $7. Never will forget that.
That wasn't
like,
even...
I couldn't kill him, man. It's my pet. But I was like, I can't deal with this hog anymore. And they get big. They get big, and they're pets, and they're real cute when they're little. But once they get big, they're hard to manage because they're tame. They don't have any fear of you. But man, were you there that time I used to kill all them snakes and feed them snakes?
Yeah, I remember all that.
He could eat a snake like nobody's business, man. He loved eating snakes.
You know, but, I remember how excited I was to hear Chancey sold his Rudy Rooter and what we were going to do with all that money. We were going to upgrade maybe from Natural Light to maybe Lone Star Light or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, maybe we was able to both buy a quart of Lone Star.
$7 we didn't have gas to get home from Sale Barn.
Yeah, that's what he brought. I never will forget that.
Me neither. I tell everybody that story.
But I also had a pet javelina too, Peppy. You remember her?
Now that one I don't remember.
You don't remember the javelina?
No, I remember the skunk that you had, and I remember Rudy Rooter, but I don't remember the javelina.
Yeah, I had a javelina. Her name was Peppy. Yeah.
Huh.
You know, she was a fun pet, but she was a one-person pet, that's for sure. But yeah, so feral hogs, man, I mean, that y'all just know they're well adapted. They can do very well in our climate. Like I said, they're in every county now in Texas except El Paso County. Many different habitats. They prefer moist bottomland, dense vegetation, rivers and creeks, ponds and lakes, marshes and sloughs, things like that. And a lot of that, y'all, is tied to they have to have free surface water. Feral hogs have to have free surface water. Helps them thermoregulate. They don't have sweat glands, so they have to wallow in the mud to cool off. Things like that. So they're never far from water.
And that itself is causing problems with E. coli and stuff around here.
Yes, yeah. Well, this is the gentleman that we're going to bring in and talk to that works for, is a wildlife biologist for Texas Wildlife Services, like an APHIS, basically a government, what we would call government trappers back in the old days. And that's where he and I met, was working on that Plum Creek project and all the E. coli, when we were killing hogs, and he's good at killing hogs. That's why I wanted him on this podcast.
Well, great, yeah. We'll have to discuss that once we get him.
Yeah, we'll get him on there. But anyway, so they're tied to water, and so that can cause all kinds of environmental issues, such as Brad was talking about, mainly just environmental water quality in the stream itself, because not only are they rooting in there and watering it, but they're also defecating in it and urinating in it and just staying there in the summer. They are really tied closely to water. They rest during the day in the most time in dense shady areas, thick brush, near water sources usually. They're most active at night or early morning and evening. However, if they don't get much pressure, much hunting pressure, they'll be out in the daytime. You can see them any time. Their diets, like I said, they range in all different kinds of habitats. They can eat just about anything they want. Anything they can catch, they'll eat it. Anything that growth, crop-wise, they can eat it, just about. Their diet, I mean, they're basically omnivores. They're omnivorous, opportunistic.
And, you know, unfortunately, I think the biggest part of their diet is cropland.
Yeah, well, especially in cropland areas. Now, you go down south Texas where it's not, it changes a little bit, but they're still need a lot of mass. But in our area, and also the rolling plains, absolutely, crops are their bigger, grains and crops are their biggest diet.
And, you know, they do a good job of spreading mosquitoes.
I've never heard that.
I'm sure they do.
I don't know. Possibly. Absolutely, yeah. They may very well. I know cattle spread a lot, but when they're droppings, I've seen mesquite beans in them. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, and I mean, acorns, that's a big part of what they eat, too.
Oh, yeah, mast. So, I mean, they basically can eat anything from grains to carrion. Carrion's just a fancy, you know, tame for dead, rotten meat, you know. I've seen them on side roads eating roadkill before.
I had no clue they would eat that.
Oh, yeah. Anything. Well, then, you know, they're also big. Like, we know that they predate on fawns, like little baby fawns they can catch. I've called in hogs to fawn bleats and also rabbit distress calling every now and then. If you've called enough, you have too. I guarantee if you get done, like, varmint calling, every now and then you'll call in a hog. And so they'll eat predators if they're basically opportunistic. Anything that can't outrun them and stay still for them, they're gonna probably eat it. And so like with fawns, it's hard to do a predation study from fawns because they eat everything. They eat the hooves, they eat the skin, they eat the hide. They'll eat every bit of it. So it's hard to find evidence of a hog killing a fawn.
Oh wow!
You know, like whereas a coyote, you can generally find some evidence. Coyotes like to half the fawns, you know, but there's generally a hoof left, you know, or something, or a leg bone, you know, they might chew on it, but generally you can see something left. Mast, they like mast, so acorns, you know, tuna pads off prickly pear, any of that stuff, any kind of mast, soft mast, hard mast. There's several regional studies that we've done the food habits of feral hogs, and one of them's in the Rolling Plains, and I think Dr. Del Rollins was part of that study. The Rolling Plains, but I mean, they kind of titled them land sharks up there because they found when they did a food habit study on feral hogs, Over all periods, grain crops constituted 35% of their food in the rolling plains. Grasses were 11%. Forbs, which is just a fancy term for weeds and wildflowers, was 14%. Soft mass, which is like plums and tuna pads, like or not tuna pads, the tuna fruit, the prickly pear tunas, the little purple things, 21%. Hard mass being, you know, mesquite, beans, acorns, up to 17%. And vertebrates and invertebrates, so basically snakes, reptiles, bugs, worms, grubs, 2%. That's in the rolling plains. In the western Rio Grande Plains in South Texas, they did a food study. And you got to remember, they don't have, you know, there's some big crop places along the valley, you know, and in certain places in South Texas. But
yeah, there's lots of it down there.
Yeah, but in the western Rio Grande Plains, where it's mostly brush country, there's not as much crop, not as much irrigation. And they've done food habit studies there. And it's roots and tubers are 17% of their diet, roots and tubers. So they're digging up greenbrier root. They like to eat a lot of greenbrier roots and other roots. And tubers are kind of like a potato, things that grow off of a root system. Forbs are 14%. Grass is 23% in South Texas for hogs. So they do graze. And if you've ever had oats, you'll see when the oats get in like a milk stage. Yeah, if you watch them long enough, you can see them. And they'll spit it out. They'll chew and get the milk out. And then they'll spit
the fiber?
Hard part, the fiber out on the ground. And if you go and walk your oat patch when it's seeding, you'll see that if hogs are hitting you. And you know, if you see those little pockets, you know, they just spit it out.
Well, you know, that's one of the best times of the year to go thermal hunting is when the wheat and oats is, you know, short enough we can still see them over the top of
mm-hmm.
it. You'll see 50, 60 deer out there and the equal number of hogs mixed amongst them, you know.
Yeah.
Grazing out there on the oats and wheat at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quite a few of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, they definitely graze. I've seen them out in pastures just grazing along. And, if they kick up a mouse and can catch it, you know, they'll eat that too. They're just opportunistic. But in South Texas, corn makes up 14%. I imagine most of that's from feeders. You know, most of that's from probably deer feeders. And there probably is some corn crops down there too, but a lot of it's probably from feeders.
Well, you know, another one of the popular places around here to thermal hunt hogs is around those big creep feeders that people have out, you know, for the calves running on pasture or oats, you know, yearlings kind of stuff. Sometimes there will be more hogs eating out of those feeders than there will be cattle.
Absolutely. And I saw a presentation that Jacob did. He has some pictures, and I forget how many hogs he killed off this one creep feeder. It's unbelievable. This guy had such a hog problem and didn't even, it's unbelievable. We'll have to ask him about that when we get it on there. It's a neat story of how he went about tackling that group, that particular problem. Back to their food habits, cactus pads in South Texas, around 5%. Vertebrates and invertebrates in South Texas are up to 7%. So think about in Rolling Plains 2, South Texas 7. So
well, something's got to take the place of the corn and the...
Absolutely.
You know, those types of grains and stuff, there just isn't any.
Yeah, highly opportunistic, y'all. So that's what you need to know. They eat anything they can catch or don't get away from them. Behavior-wise, they're intelligent animals. They adapt to nearly anything. They're crepuscular. We kind of talked about how they move. They use shade, wallows. They can get really smart if pressure... The social structure of them is sows and litters travel in groups they call sounders. You know, so a group of hogs or herd of hogs is technically called a sounder. Adult boars are typically solitary. Little young boars will pair up or even gang up and, like, get their buddies when they're young, and you'll catch a lot of them. But a full-grown adult boar, when he's an adult male, is generally by himself except the breeding season. You always hear about that lone boar. Remember, we always used
all
to
talk about
one big hog. It was one lone boar that was always bedded in a particular spot. We never could kill him, didn't have the dog power. But, yeah, so they're solitary. Home range movement, their home range can range from 2 to 10 square miles. And just like deer, boars have a larger home range than sows. Just depends on how much food is out there, how much water is out there. The home ranges change from season to season. They change where they go, where the food's at. They go where the water's at.
Summertime, and you know, they
go to the cornfields and the croplands, to the blackland. Wintertime, they move back into post oaks to where the acorns are at.
And around here, they follow the creeks and rivers and streams. I mean, I guess they probably would go farther up and down that, being as though we had, like, there's not much cover once you get away from that.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're 100% tied. They follow the creeks in the drainage systems. But like I said, boars will travel further. It's all dependent on how much food is available, how much resources, how far they got to travel for food. But in general, a sow, when she has little young piglets, little baby pigs, she don't move, go very far. She stays very local until they can get up and going readily. You know, she'll stay really close to them.
And she'll watch them
when they're little. Yeah, and this is really a neat thing. This is a neat thing about feral hogs and hogs in general, wild hogs. They're the only large mammal that builds a nest. I'm pretty certain on there. There may be another one, but it's the only one that I know, the large mammal. Like a sow will build a nest for her piglets. When she gets ready to pig, she'll build a nest. Like bring all kinds of stuff together, and she'll have her babies in that. Yeah, which is pretty cool. Just a little tidbit about hogs. If you're ever on Jeopardy and they ask for that.
You know, and I remember years ago, I was driving through a pasture checking cows, and there was a whole sow drill. There was a sow with like two or three sows with a bunch of little babies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't little babies. They were like getting pretty good size, you know, good size for like barbecuing, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm gonna see if I could sneak up there and grab one of them, you know, take home and make some good barbecue.
Sure.
Well, they take off running, and so I jump out of the truck and I take off running after them, and I grab one of the slower ones, obviously. And I grab hold of that sucker. I got him by the back legs, and boy, he starts squealing up a storm. And man, that mama sow, I mean, she stopped dead in her tracks and turned around. I barely got back. Like, I mean, as she was coming after me, I was trying to get that hog back to the truck. I'd finally let it go. Yeah, them suckers, they watch their baby.
Oh, yeah, they will. And, like, to me, it's been one of two things. Either one of them will stand their grounds and protect their babies, or either they just to heck with them and abandon their babies and just go off running.
So depends, it's one on way or the other.
That's what I've seen. I mean, I've seen them do both, you know. Boar hogs, you corner him, he's going to, any hog, any wild animal, you corner him, you put him in a trap, they're going to defend themselves. And they can be very aggressive. But yeah, my encounters with sows, with little piglets, they'll either kind of bluff you or come at you, or either they just run too. They're just scared of you, you know. So that's been my experience with them. But no, I've heard stories just like yourself. I've never been charged by a hog unless, like, I was trying to kill it. Had, I guess, a reason. It was justified to come after me, I guess. Yeah, no, they can be. So just be aware, y'all. Like, if you're not familiar with hogs and you happen to be listening to this, give them credit where credit is due. They demand respect, especially, like, you go to building traps or trying to catch one, or you can't overbuild a trap. They're very strong and they're very intelligent. They can find a weak spot on a trap and just keep hit it, and, you know, very intelligent. So I guess feral hog expansion. How do we get so many so fast? Why are they everywhere now? We're going to fix and wrap up biology here in just a second. So I want to go through this pretty fast. Well, in 1988, they were in 462 U.S. counties. In 2004, they were in 1,042 U.S. counties, increase of 125%. 39 states and 4 Canadian provinces. As of 2006, they were there. And now, as of 2019, feral hogs have been reported in 39 out of the 50 states in the United States of America. So I guess the state and Texas data from 2022 has indicated that feral hogs are now established in 253 of the 254 counties. The only county that doesn't have them as of 2022 or hasn't reported them yet is El Paso County, way out there west. And I imagine it's just a matter of time before they...
Yeah, that really escalated quickly.
Yeah, very, very fast. So how do we get so many so fast? Well, number one, they're generalist omnivores. What we said, they're opportunists. They can eat anything. They're intelligent. So you start pressuring them, they learn. One of the biggest reason we got so many so fast is indiscriminate stalkings. It's illegal to move feral hogs and release feral hogs, but it happened. It happened quite a bit in the early 90s when they were starting. Unfortunately, when you hunt an animal and you can create a revenue off of an animal, it gives them potential to protect them, potential to move them, to hunt them, you know, whether it be fun, recreation, or for you can make money off of them. So we did a lot of this problem ourselves by moving them. Supplementally fed hogs are more healthy, and they have healthy hogs have more baby. There's not a doubt in my mind that we are making our feral hog problem worse by feeding deer. Not a doubt in my mind, especially if you're not excluding your feeders from hogs. They have crazy high reproductive rates. Fecundity, potential. Basically, we'll just put this, that hogs, feral hogs, are the most prolific large wild mammal in all of North America. They have an early maturation. Basically, that means they just can mature and hit breeding maturity at a very early age. have a very short gestation period, and they have very large litters once they become adult. When I say gestation, that's just, you've always heard 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days, 114 days. It's somewhere in that neighborhood, you know, just the gestation period of a hog.
Well, and she could have, and sows can have babies at like 6 months old.
Yes. Breed at 6 months become, old? The females become sexually mature at 6 months old. And so then that means that that sow, so you can just take, okay, so fecundity, how many babies they have, it kind of depends on age. So like a juvenile generally has 2 babies per litter. A yearling, which would be like a 1.5-year-old to 2-year-old hog, has 4 per litter. And an adult female, adult sow, they'll have anywhere from 8 to 10 babies per litter. And they dang near can raise every single one of them. They have plenty of teats, and they can raise them all, produce plenty of milk. And like I said earlier, well-fed hogs have more young. They just, if you're healthy, you have more babies. And so if you just take a hog, say hog A, sow A, and you breed her, at the end of 2 years, she can has the ability to produce her and her offspring an additional 318 pigs.
Oh, my.
At the year end of 2 years. So there. That's the thing. It's hard to keep up. Even with, you know, you're killing them, you're trapping them, you're doing everything, it's really, really, really hard to keep up with their reproductive rate.
And they have about the same number of male offspring as female offspring, too.
Generally in utero, and even what hits the ground, it's about 50-50, males and females.
That's a good ratio for prolificacy.
And I mean, you think about it, I mean, when the little sows can breed at 6 months age and they have their babies, they have them when they're 9 months old. Well, you just do the math on the gestation. Technically, if they didn't raise the babies, they could have 3 litters a year, but they don't. They can't, because when you take into account, mama's got to raise the babies, mama's got to feed the babies, mama's got to take care of the babies. So you're looking at they have about 1.5 to 2 litters per year.
Yeah, and it probably takes them back time to get back into, you know, body condition enough for to maintain pregnancy. And all
numbers-wise, you could hit 3, just like, technically, a deer can grow 3 sets of antlers in a year, but they don't. So as far as litters per year of a mature hog, it's about 1.5. So you just look at their breeding potential and their population control. So if you reduce their population of feral hogs by 70%, it will rebound within 2.5 years.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah, you reduce it by 95%, it'll do it in about 5.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, so that's what we're up against.
And so that's the reason that that control is so important.
Yes, extremely control, which is what we're going to go into, because basically you can keep them out, you can chase them out, or you can carry them out. And anybody that has land, any landowner in Texas, is going to be interested in feral hog control.
And yeah, Chancey, so I mean, I guess that's why, you know, control is so important when you have something that prolific.
Absolutely, Bradley. And when it comes to controlling feral hogs, the gentleman I had mentioned earlier, his name is Jacob Hetzel. And he works for, he's a wildlife biologist for Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, which is under that branch, is Texas Wildlife Services. And I first met Jacob when we were working on the Plum Creek Project way down there in Lockhart. And so we were basically working in Hays and Caldwell counties. And I reached out to Jacob. Like I said, in the old days, he would have been, I guess, called what the old-timers used to call government trappers. But Jacob works with Wildlife Services. He's a wildlife biologist for him. And I reached out to him, and he was gracious enough to spend some time with us today. So we have him on the phone right now with us. And Jacob, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing good.
Well, good, man. Well, thanks for coming on. And what I was thinking is maybe just introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about you and what you do for a living.
So I work for Texas Wildlife Services, which is a part of the AgriLife Extension. And what we do is we deal with nuisance wildlife. So basically everything except white-tailed deer. And so if it involves economic loss or property damage or any type of human health and safety aspect, that's what we deal with. So a lot of feral hog work, some predator work, and then some other nuisance, vultures and beavers and whatever else comes along.
Well, that's right. When I first met you, we were working with feral hogs, but when I first met you, you were working on a project in Austin, coyotes. You were doing coyotes. Wasn't that true? That would have been back in, what, 09, 10?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So there was a there was the city of Austin and Travis County had an urban coyote program where we were working with residents there that were having issues with coyotes that were harassing people, harassing pets, killing pets. And so that program lasted about 10 years. It started in 2004.
Well, I imagine you had a lot of PR issues in that job.
We did.
And you have, I mean, man, that was like an Aggie going over there into Longhorn land too, buddy. Come to find out, me and Jacob both graduated the same year from Texas A&M, 2004, if that tells you how old we are.
Living behind the orange curtain over there.
Oh, buddy, yeah, I mean, tell you, you were brought in with open arms over there, huh? Yes, sirs, and so you and Chancey got, that's where he first got to know you at, I guess.
Yes, sir, so we were doing a water quality project on Plum Creek, the basis of the project was to look at feral swine, feral hogs, were they contributing bacteria to the water? And so we did a project on Plum Creek watershed. There's two branches or three branches of Plum Creek, but there was the Clear Fork and a West Fork. And so we took water samples, and then we did a controlled area where we didn't do anything. On the West Fork over there, we went ahead and did a bunch of aerial hunting and removed a bunch of pigs. And then we took more water samples, and we were just looking at how much bacteria were the feral hogs contributing to the watershed. And so it was some. They do have an impact.
Absolutely.
So.
They ran the stats on it, and they have an effect. Like the Jacob and his crew, them killing all those hogs, it made an effect. The water quality improved. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you don't even really, like, think about as being an issue. You know, I mean, but I guess by and large it is, being as though they follow all those creeks and streams and stuff, you know, and spend a lot of time in them.
Yeah. And so that's kind of where I met Jacob. And then not only that, I wanted to bring him in because Jacob has killed more feral hogs than anybody that I know. And he was actually the first time I ever even saw night vision on a gun was with Jacob. Jacob took me out one night, and we went to, you remember that mitigation site out there, Jacob, by Lockhart?
Yes.
Yeah, and it was before thermals. It was night vision then. I imagine everybody's at thermal now, but it was a big deal because I'd never seen it before, and it was really cool. But Jacob was the first one to show me that, and since then, he's been doing that and going on and killing hogs a lot now. You're back in Brenham area now, right, living? So no longer in Austin.
Correct.
Jacob, like, in your opinion, what you do for a living, some control methods for hogs, what works, what doesn't work? What do you suggest for the landowner out there listening right now, you know, and a way to approach his hog problem that he may have?
So there's a lot of tools in the toolbox. 15 years ago when I first met you, night vision was available, but it was expensive and thermal was just out of reach. And now times have changed, technology's caught up. If you put 10 people in a room that spend out time outdoors, there's probably at least two or three, if not five of them that have thermal. The price of thermals has come down. And so everybody has thermal. Lots of people use thermal. And thermal and night hunting is a great way to, it's a good way to have fun. It's a good way to manage hogs, control numbers.
You know, Jacob,
I
teach at the high school, and like what you just said, I bet three out of every five high school kids over there now have thermal scopes on there.
Correct.
You know, I asked one got one for Christmas, and I said, well, how much was that? And he was like, oh, I think it was like $2,000 or something. And I was like, wow, that really has gotten quite a bit cheaper.
So you can get in the thermal game. You can get in the mid to upper level thermal game for between $2,000 and $5,000. And so what I try to tell people with the thermal stuff is, just because you can afford it, it's the time. And so you're going to invest a lot of time into doing that work. So for the most part, pigs are nocturnal. So if you work an 8-to-5 job, then how many days in a row can you go do feral hog stuff at night from 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night to 2 o'clock in the morning, and then get up and make it to work the next day? So it's a time deal. A lot of people do it for a hobby, but it's the time investment if you're truly using it as a tool, you're going to dedicate a lot of time to chasing pigs with night vision and thermal at night.
Yeah, you bring up a good point there.
But as far as other things, probably the most effective is still trapping, you know, large traps. And that's come a long, long way to the way I started out doing it was, I'd say, corral trapping with a stick and a string. So you had a corral trap and you had some type of head gate, some type of trap door, and you had it propped open somehow with a stick or some type of hinge, and then you had a tripwire in there. You didn't really know how many pigs were coming in the trap, and you ran out there every single day and checked your trap, and then, you know, sometimes you'd catch a big group, and sometimes you'd just catch a small group, but it worked, and that's what we did, and technology's come so far now. You know, trail cameras are inexpensive. We have cellular trail cameras that text you all the pictures to your phone. As far as the trapping has changed, you know, automated systems. So you now have hog traps that take still pictures and send them to your phone. You have hog trap. You have automated systems that shoot live video, and they're sending you real time video of what's going on in your trap, and you can shut that trap off of your phone. And so it that's been a real game changer in the hog trapping and part of it.
Man, I mean, the future is here in that case. And isn't there a state program where the state will actually like loan you one of those traps or something like that to use to trap those hogs?
There's some counties that have programs that do trap loans. I'm not aware of a state program, but there's a lot of counties that are doing trap loan, and they loan different types of traps and different styles of traps and stuff out.
Okay, yes, sir. It must be the county then. I want to say that somebody here has told me that they've brought those traps out to their property and set them up. They were able to use them to trap those hogs. Now, because that's a really cool deal, man, whenever you could activate that thing with your cell phone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is a game changer right there. You know, when you're couch watching TV and your phone goes off, you're like, oh, yeah, that's all. They're all in the pen or all in the trap. Let's set it off. Wow.
I mean, isn't that something?
Yeah. But heck, Jacob, I remember one of the presentations you were giving that I saw. I didn't even know they made it. Blew my mind. I was like, man, that is a great idea. They had a trap that was basically, it reminded me like one of those portable corrals that the sale barn and those cattle people use, but it was for hogs. Like it was a hog trap on a trailer that you could just drive out to where you wanted it and set it up.
Oh, wow.
I know it's a little pricey, but it's a neat idea, you know, like if you got a serious problem or
something.
Sure,
yeah. Move it from place to place easily.
Yeah, I think so. Correct. I've never used one. So I forgot the name of it.
There's several companies that are doing that, but that's what I've been utilizing is portable panels. So traditionally, you bought 16-foot or 20-foot panels, and you drove a T-post in the ground every 5 to 7 feet, and you built this, and then every T-post you tied with wire up and down that post, you tied those panels 3 or 4 times, and it was just really labor-intensive. And so I found a manufacturer that was making panels about 7 or 8 years ago, and we've been using those panels. Some advantages, some disadvantages to them, I guess. The biggest advantage is they're portable. They're 6 feet tall. They're 10 foot long. They pin together like portable cow pins. You can set one up and you can take one down. If you have two people, you're looking at about 15 minutes or 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And so that's changed, you know, made moving traps and doing things. That's been a game changer.
You know what one of those of a decent size would cost you?
Depends what company you go with, but just a ballpark number. Just think about $200 a panel, somewhere in that neighborhood. Maybe a little under, maybe a little over, but about $200 a panel. I use 8 to 10 panels, and then you need a head gate. So you're talking about $2,000 to $2,500 is a good starting point.
Man, but much easier than driving T-posts.
Yes.
Goodness gracious.
If you think about it, if you go buy 20-foot panels, I don't know when the last time you've bought 20-foot panels and all that stuff. I mean, you're going to be spending like $2,000 anyway if you try to build one yourself.
Yeah.
About $90 a piece.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I had no clue that somebody came up with something like that. That's pretty handy.
And you found, Jacob, that the 8 to 10 panels, the 10 foot, that's kind of the optimum size, easy to haul, not, doesn't take too long to set up. As far as size-wise, you catching plenty of hogs, so, catch a big groups?
Correct. So what I like to do is we get into the how I'd go about trapping pigs.
Yes.
I use trail cameras a lot, and sometimes it sounds, when I talk to landowners, sometimes it sounds crazy to them, but I'm not a, you have some hog damage here in this spot, we're going to build a trap. I'll be here with a trap tomorrow to catch them. That's not how I'd been running my program. That's not how I've been doing things. So a lot of it has to do with training pigs. And essentially, that's what you're doing is training them. So I typically feed those pigs for 4 to 5 days. It may be shorter. It may be longer. It just depends on how long it takes them to find bait. Depends on how long it takes them to cooperate. But you want to find the area where you plan on building this trap at. And, you know, everybody wants to put the trap. They're digging in my coastal field right here in front of my house. I can look out the window in the morning when I'm drinking coffee and I can see if there's pigs in my trap. And typically that's not where you want to set up your trap at. You want to find a place that's kind of protected, close to where they're, where their cover is, where they feel safe, where they've got water, not exactly out in the open, not out in the middle of the field. But when you figure out where you want to trap them at, make sure it's still accessible for you to get there. But just throw up a trail camera and start feeding those pigs, and you want to get a count on how many pigs you have coming. That plays a part into how big of a trap you build. You know, how much corn do you feed them? That depends on how many pigs you got coming. You can start by throwing out 10 or 15 pounds of corn. This is just an opinion thing, but a deer feeder does not throw enough corn to keep those pigs coming. You need to give them 10, 15 pounds of corn to start with. If you get a bunch of pigs coming, you're going to have to keep upping that. You know, if you have a big group of pigs, say you have 30 to 40 pigs coming, they'll eat up 50 pounds of corn in 20 to 30 minutes.
Does any of those attractants work? Does any of those like commercial attractants work that people make now and sell?
You know, a lot of them do work. I don't typically use commercial attractants. The first time I set up a bait site, if it's a new spot, nothing's ever been done there, pigs have never been fed there, I usually add about a gallon or 2 or 3 pounds of ground feed, just any kind of sweet feed that you'd get at the feed store. Kind of sprinkle that on the top of it when I throw corn out. And then after the first time, after they find the bait site, then I typically back off and don't use any kind of other attractant other than just corn.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned the sweet feed part there, because I own a feed store and we sell attractants, and you were kind of hammering my business there for a little bit. But
you totally
recovered with that sweet feed deal, so I appreciate that.
Well, the more you talk to people, everybody has a secret bait, and I don't knock anybody's secret bait at all. So whatever works for you, that's what you should use. You know, guys have a secret bait, and they use this and this and this. And if that's what works for you, then continue using it.
Yeah, but corn is cheap, and it's readily available. And
correct.
You can get it just about anywhere, and hogs definitely like it.
But what I will do is I'll set up a bait site, and I'll monitor that bait site. Once pigs get on the bait, I get a count how many pigs are coming here. I got 18 pigs coming. And so I'll feed them for 2 or 3 nights, make sure they're coming good. Typically what will happen is those pigs start coming earlier and earlier and earlier. So if they find the bait site the first night and they come at 3 o'clock in the morning, typically, not all the time, but typically by the time you get to the third day, the fourth day, they're coming within an hour of sunset, or, you know, at least 2 to 3 hours after sunset. And so they get earlier and earlier and earlier. And then what you want to do is you want to build your trap in the exact same location where you've been feeding those pigs for the last 4 or 5 days. What I like to do is leave that trap open. I have panel traps. The panels are 10 foot. I'll open up the head gate, which is 6 feet wide, and I'll open up in a panel. Theoretically, those pigs have a 16 foot opening to go in and out of that. And I'll just feed them. I'll just feed them inside, outside that trap for 2 or 3 days and let them get comfortable with it. And then I'll close it And then I'll feed them another night or two inside the trap and just give them plenty of time. They get used to all that because anything that's new in their environment, it kind of a lot of times it throws up a red flag.
I was going to ask you, Jake, when you go initially after you've fed them, you know, three or four times with no panels, no trap there, just feeding them and getting them coming real good. When you go to set your trap up, do you put the whole thing up when you set it just from a time constraint wise? I mean, that makes sense. Or do you like put half of it up or just put the gates up first? Or what do you, how do you
I typically put it all up. Put it all there.
After they've been coming three or 4 days.
Correct. And pigs are, it depends on how much pressure's been put on them. And sometimes it happens, you have these pigs coming and man, they're waiting on you for pre-bait. You're coming there and you're feeding them at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And as soon as they hear the vehicle drive off, they're eating corn. And so you think, man, I got these pigs, they're in my back pocket. And you go set your trap up and they never come back again. Like months can go by and they never come back to that site.
Yeah. Chancey talked about how intelligent that they are.
That doesn't happen a lot. It does happen pretty frequently that you feed them in a bait site, you build a trap, and the first night they're pretty shy about it. And then if you'll give them another 2, 3, 4 nights, they'll start coming. It does happen that they've seen the trap, they've had a bad experience with a trap, they know about a trap, and then they don't ever come back.
And is there still a market for those hogs? Like once you get you some of them, is there anything to do with those things anymore? I remember years ago there was a few local people that would buy them for like a decent amount of money, but I don't know if that's still, there's still a market for them or not.
I don't deal on that side of stuff. We're side that I work for, wildlife services side, we're straight up, everything is nothing leaves a trap alive, but there are some places where it is a market, and but it's up and down different times of the year and things like that. So it depends on where you are. Texas Animal Health Commission has a website. Since pigs are categorized as livestock, they're the ones that are in charge of all that. And their website has a list of those buying stations you can go to and their website and figure out if there's a buyer close to you.
Okay, that makes sense. There used to be several in our area, but I think that's dwindled down over the years. I don't think there's hardly any of them left anymore.
Well, I remember there for a while they got so low that it almost wasn't worth trapping them. People were just like,
it wasn't worth the cost of corn.
I mean, yeah, they were trapping them to get rid of them, to kill them, because they needed them gone, and they wouldn't even take them to sell because it wasn't worth driving over there when gas prices were so high. But I don't know, they may have gone back up now.
Yeah, does any of the non-lethal methods work anymore, like those crow guns or any type of fencing, electric fence or any of that stuff worth messing with anymore?
You know, land fragmentation is a big issue. I'm sure it's just as big a deal in Milan County as it is in Washington County. And so properties are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But we're still faced with the same issues with pigs. When I meet with a small landowner, somebody bought a piece of property, they're not planning on leaving. They bought a 10, 20 acre piece of property and it's new to them. Really try to push people to put up net wire fencing around their property. If it's a small acreage and they're going to be there, it's not really affordable for larger landowners to do that. Net wire is still a really good option. As long as there's nothing more appealing on your side of the fence than there is on your neighbor's side of the fence. If your neighbor's property is exactly the same as yours and all the neighbors around your property are exactly the same as yours, putting up a net wire fence is going to be a benefit. It's not going to do anything to reduce the pig population, but it's going to keep you from having to deal with that problem.
And, you know, it's been my experience here recently since there's been more and more of that net wire used. It's pretty hard on deer. I've seen several deer tangled up inside of that stuff.
People can approach that how they want to, but it's a valuable thing. Now, if you're going to try to have a crop inside of a net wire fence, if everybody around you is pasture or, you know, nothing really improved, and then you decide in your property you're going to plant a grain crop, you're going to try to grow corn or grain sorghum or something like that, then you're probably not going to keep them out with a net wire fence.
Makes so, sense. You got what they need.
Yes. Yeah, so, but anyway, as far as other non-lethal stuff, you know, electric fences can work. It's just really, just be really labor intensive trying to keep that clean and trying to keep them out. I know several guys that do put electric wire around the bottom of their fiber wire fence, and it will keep the pigs out. It's just a constant maintenance of keeping it all clean and keeping it going. Oh, you said something a while ago about the propane cannons, about the crow guns. You know, I've had several cooperators that use them trying to keep pigs out of a cornfield. And if you'll move them pretty frequently, and then you're doing something besides running those propane cannons, they can work, but the pigs get used to them pretty quick.
Yes,
you know,
sir.
there's no consequences. It's just a loud boom, and they get used to it. And, you know, if you're using some other tool, if you're shooting pigs in between that or doing something else, then they can definitely help. But,
well, you know, that aerial hunting, like by helicopter, is really starting to take off too.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you have any experience with that or not.
We do a little bit. Like I said, in this part of the world where we're at here, this Central Texas, land fragmentation is a big deal. So you can cover a lot of ground in a helicopter. You can cover 15 to 20,000 acres in a day in a helicopter. Chansey can tell you stories. We did an aerial project in Caldwell County on the Plum Creek project, and we signed up. We had 10,000 acres that we were flying, and we have 400 landowners is what we ended up with to get 10,000 acres together.
Oh, my God. Yes. Wow.
And so to verify that, in Caldwell County, is very similar to Washington County or Milam County, highly fragmented. Jacob and I, Jacob, you know, we spent months on the phone and calling people to get that much land. And then the place that you needed, the property that you needed, wouldn't give us permission, and Jacob and his crew couldn't fly over there.
So you had to go around it?
Had to go around it, and that's where the hogs were at.
Oh, because they went where was their safe haven.
Yeah, and that was the problem. So it's like, you know, everybody needs to get on the same board with feral hogs, but what we talked about earlier, you know, one of your neighbors might love feral hogs, another neighbor hates them, so.
And that's a big deal. Everybody has a different opinion about pigs, and there's landowners that, you know, literally they hate the pigs. They see the damage and destruction that they do, and they would do anything possible to get rid of the pigs. And then another landowner says, well, I don't mind the pigs being around here, and my grandkids like to shoot them, or I have hunters and the hunters like to shoot them. And so there's a big spread on when it comes to opinions on feral hogs. There's a big spread there. So
yes, it's hard to get
everybody on the same page.
Yes, sir. And I mean, I remember back in the 90s when me and Chansey were running dogs on the creek close to our house. I mean, we had to call, you know, I mean, to run them like 3 miles, we had to call like 15 people to get approval, you know, to go through their places with the dogs. And like you said, one person would say no, and that just really threw a hitch into the whole deal.
But yeah, I mean, absolutely. They just, everybody has their opinion about hogs. But so, like, when it comes to control methods, like Jacob was talking about, yeah, if you got a big enough land, you're way down in South Texas, then yeah, it can be useful. But in our neck of the woods, it's exactly what Jacob said. I mean, just to get the amount of land, and if you to do it, you're probably best with fencing or trapping, you know. And trapping works, definitely.
You know, I have to ask this, and you may not even remember, but what's the largest amount of hogs you ever caught in a trap at one time?
68.
Oh, my God. 68? Man, where was that at?
It was in Washington County.
Goodness gracious, what year?
It was in 24. Pigs play such an impact on the livestock industry that a lot of producers don't even realize how much they're losing out on to pigs. This cooperator had got in touch with me, and it was not a feeder cattle operation. He was a cow calf operation, and he was creep feeding some calves. He had some calves that were 4 to 5 months old, and he was just supplemental feeding them. And he thought he was losing feed to feral hogs. I set up some cameras around a creep feeder And I figured out that the pigs, they were not leaving the feeder. So they were there 24 hours a day.
Even during the daytime?
During the daytime. They didn't leave. They were there. And so, and his cattle were not getting any supplement out of it. I did not have any pictures. Did not have any pictures of calves feeding out of the feeder.
Oh, my God. The hogs was eating every bit of it.
The hogs were eating every bit of it. They were eating, a ton. 40 bags. They were eating a ton in 4 to 5 days.
Holy cow.
You know, you're in the feed business. You know, you're talking $450-$500 a ton, and they were eating that, you know, they're eating $100 a day. So
my goodness gracious. And that's where you trapped those 68 at?
So I did a project. I built a trap around the creep feeder. I had about a 42 foot diameter trap. So, about 13 panels, and I did the same thing, but yes, sir, I took 140 pigs from one creek feeder, and then I moved to another site, same property, about a half a mile away. And I took another 90 something off of there. So I took 235 pigs.
That is astronomical. My God, they were probably pretty fat too, weren't they?
They're very healthy.
Man, buddy, golly.
What was that time frame you removed them? Just in, what, a few months you removed that many? Or how long did it take you to get all those?
It was probably a month total.
Wow.
Probably a month total.
But that's really short, though.
So, you know, I was, you're kind of cutting the corner there because you already had a bait site. So those pigs were already used to coming to that feeder.
Sure.
All the time. I needed to get an idea how many I was dealing with. You know, once I figured out, hey, I have a bunch of pigs, it was trying to decide, well, how big of a trap do I build?
Yeah.
And then once I built the trap, it was getting them conditioned, getting them to come in the trap. And then it was just a matter of getting them caught. And so I actually, when I did that project, I had to shut the trap down. I had to close the door and lock the pigs out because I couldn't keep them out of there. And so I would shut the trap and I would go in the evening and open the trap and bait everything. And then let them come in the evenings. But other than that, otherwise they were there. They'd have all the corn, all the extra bait and everything. They'd have it all cleaned up and during the daytime, and you would never get the whole entire group. So,
my God.
Goodness gracious. I can't imagine how much work it was after you caught them all and what you had to do with them then. That's a whole lot of shooting. Goodness gracious.
Yeah, that's a bunch of ammo there, too.
It's a bunch of ammo, yes, sir.
God, dog, man. Was that close to a river bottom or something?
It was fairly close to the river, yes, sir.
Goodness gracious alive.
But that doesn't matter. You know, whenever you have a food source, and y'all talked about that earlier with biology, but when they have that type of food source, it just changes everything. It changes all their reproductive capabilities, all that stuff. So they're in optimum condition when they have that type of food source. And so then that just raises the bar on everything. You know, it just jumps everything up.
Oh, right, man. But, that's probably another liter a year per sow or so, probably. And get with that kind of nutrition.
Well, they ain't sure raise every one of them, that's for sure. They ain't unhealthy. Plenty of milk.
Yes, sir. But, well, Jacob, I think, man, that was pretty good information there on how to control hogs. I mean, in your ranking, I guess you would say trapping's probably about the best, huh?
I think the best thing is that you know what's going on and you're trying to do some type of management. You know, do what works for you. Doing thermal or night vision, if that works for you, do that. If trapping works for you, do that. If some type of exclusion works, do that. Whatever it is, whatever method there is, just be proactive. And it's hard for people to understand. We're a long way from controlling population of pigs, but really what you're trying to do is control the damage on your property. If you have extensive damage on your property and you start doing some type of management, you start trapping or shooting and doing that stuff, and the damage gets less, and it continues to get less, then you've had success. And so I like to look at feral hog management on a damage management aspect. It's not how many pigs you trapped across the board. It's the people that you trapped on or the individuals that are doing trapping. Did it make a difference on their property?
Yes,
and,
sir.
If it made a difference for them and they didn't lose as much in production this year, or they didn't have as much damage, then it's a success.
Yes, sir. Like you said, there is no cure. All you can do is manage it.
Correct.
Yes, sir. Well, man, Jacob, I appreciate it, bud. I mean, I think that about covers it.
Yeah, unless there's anything else you want to throw in, Jacob, as far as trapping-wise goes, or something you just, you know, for like the typical landowner, if there's anything else, man, feel free to share. But we really appreciate you coming on and taking your Sunday afternoon and giving us some time. We really, really thank you, Jacob.
Oh, no problem.
Yes, sir. And like, since you work with the public, is there a way people can get a hold of you if they need to?
I can get you some info. Our district office is in College Station. That would be the best place to start.
That's great. That's exactly what we need. Yeah. No, we appreciate it, Jacob. Thank you for taking your time today, my friend.
All righty, sir. Y'all have a good day.
You too, bud.
Appreciate it, sir.
So, yeah, Chansey. So, I mean, that was Jacob with some good information on trapping and hunting with helicopters and a lot of conventional methods that are available. That's really useful for landowners and a good way to control a lot of these hogs.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff, you know, it's all about their practicality and what works for you. Like Jacob Enden, you know, saying it's really just going to depends on what works on you and where do you have success. And when it comes to trapping and control methods, but there's some other things out there too that we'd like to bring up and mention, you know, kind of where things are going or maybe going.
Yeah, like a whole new generation of things, and I guess one of those things being, you know, there's going to be like this new generation of like poisons, I guess, or toxins that you could use to actually control hogs, and believe it or not, a good friend of mine in Chansey from back when we were kids is now with the Farm Bureau, and Tracy Tomasic is actually here with us today. Tracy, how's it going there, old buddy?
Well, things are going well, and thanks for the opportunity to come in and visit with you about one of the issues I've been working with for, gosh, 8 years now since it's come on the scene in Texas.
Wow, Tracy, I didn't know you've been working with that specifically for that long.
I mean, it seems like just yesterday, Tracy, that, you know, my mom and Chansey's mom both worked at Buckholz ISD here right up the road at Buckholz, Texas. And Tracy, you know, his whole family.
Yeah, we all went to school together. Yeah, we've been friends forever. So, small world,
yeah.
Man.
We used to.
Yeah, it is a small world. And, you know, when you've got astounding fellas like yourselves coming up through Milam County, you know, you were in a few years older than me. You made really excellent role models.
Well, man,
so,
buddy,
look at me now.
I remember like it was yesterday. I mean, me and Tracy and his cousin Mike and a bunch of other people playing football back behind the goalpost at the 6-man football games when we were like 10, 11 years old. Chansey was out back there in that tree line behind the visitors bleachers looking for native grass species and stuff.
What I remember about all that stuff is we used to, when it got cold at Buckholz, we would run relays, and Tracy was one of the fastest kids. You always wanted Tracy on your team if you were running relays because he was so doggone fast, man.
Well, it was
right, but being fast out of six isn't a whole lot of competition.
I mean, man, it was them good Frito pies they had in that concession stand over there that made everybody so fast, I guess. Hot dog. It seems like yesterday. You know, here we are all these years later, and Tracy's with the Farm Bureau now.
Yeah, Tracy. Yeah. So just tell us a little bit about what you do and what you do for a living with Farm Bureau. Yeah. And all this work that you've done in the legislative wise.
Well, so appreciate it. And I'll be brief. I work in our government affairs division, and I focus on the regulatory and commodity issues dealing with livestock and animal health. When it comes to feral hogs, we really didn't have a staff person that was interested in messing or tackling these issues. When the toxicants came around back in January of 2017, if you might remember, that legislative session is when there were a lot of headlines in February, March, and April about this product and a ton of misinformation. And we worked through it, you know, because it's a big issue. Feral hogs are for farms and ranchers. all across Texas, and specifically with the legislature, this product called Caput feral hog bait is utilizing warfarin or Coumaphos as its active ingredient. And being a human drug as well, well, it came with a whole lot of angst, to put it lightly.
Oh, that's right. It's a blood thinner, folks, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's how it works. And I won't get into the scientific details and how pigs die, but, you know, after a couple of days of consuming it, depending on the size of that pig, they'll end up internally bleeding out, dispatching themselves. That's a win-win when it comes to getting rid of pigs. At the end of the day, there's, from a farmer and ranch standpoint, trying to reduce the populations of them, and this has turned out to be an effective tool.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the exact same active ingredient used for years now to control rats and mice, right?
It is. And I'll tell you just briefly about the company that's put this product on the market. They've been in the business of controlling rodents and pests for decades. It's privately owned up out of Colorado. And they've got a whole lineup of things that I was unaware of prior to this product coming online. Through a bunch of research, it just turns out they've actually, it's a pretty reputable company that's decided to tackle one of the biggest issues in Texas.
And boy, they knew they were going to be up against it when they started that too, didn't they?
Yeah, there was quite the ruckus when our Department of Agriculture made the big announcement that they approved this product for use in Texas. It did it. With a big show to go along with it. Unfortunately, it didn't come along with a lot of factual information. So that's where people had concern, is wanting to know more about the product. Because look, it was a new product, a new area, and a new pest, and tackling it in a new way. So there were so many questions that it took a long while to first and foremost calm folks down about this. Because let's face it, it's a poison. And we're putting it in a mammal that's never been poisoned before on purpose. The other side of it, and I know we've all talked about this before, is some folks use feral hogs as a dining delicacy or just part of their regular meal. And so there's obviously a good reason for some angst and concern when you don't know much about it.
But, now that the research has been done and all, it could clear people's minds a little bit, huh?
Yeah, I really became a lot more comfortable once I sat down and read the multiple EPA trials that are required for any kind of a product that's a toxicant and, you know, governed by the FIFRA regulations, which part of my job is to know about those kind of things. And FIFRA is the fungicide, insecticide, pesticide regulatory authority out of D.C. And it's not the authority, but that's the rule in which the Environmental Protection Agency utilizes to make sure that things are safe and effective when they're applied according to the labels.
Yes, sir. What typically, now that it's been approved, Tracy, is the protocol for using that?
So it is not an easy product to use. So if you're concerned with it, feel confident that if somebody has gone to the trouble to gain access to this limited use product, that they've got a little extra training under the belt. So since it's limited use in Texas, you got to have a pesticide applicator's license or be working on behalf of somebody that's licensed. So ultimately, the company that manufactures the product has required an additional level or additional specific training for a person to be able to access this product. So you got to go online and spend some time studying the product before you read the label and then go out and apply it. And if you talk to trappers, and I know you talked to, I believe it was Jacob earlier, they've got some experience with this as well. Texas Wildlife Services and then even AgriLife did some experimental studies to prove that the product works. They did that over 2021 and 2022, then submitted that, or 2022 and 2023, and then submitted that data to the Texas legislature. Ultimately, you could get another good Czech young man from Williamson County on here to talk about it, John Tomaszek. He could take you through the ins and outs of that study, but when it was all said and done, the results were, if you follow the label, which means you're going to be applying this product for about a month, you're going to be training pigs for about a month to eat out of a specialized feeder that limits access to only pigs. Within the last 7 to 10 days, you'll end up wiping out, if you do it right, all the hogs that were coming to that feeder and eating the bait.
And is it like, where do you have to buy these feeders, Tracy? Is it something you purchase somewhere?
The label of the product says you got to have apply this product in a feeder with a 17-pound lid. Now, you can buy one that's offered by the manufacturer. It's going to run you close to $1,000, if I remember correctly. Or you could take an old galvanized hog feeder and put a 17-pound weight on the self-feeder lid, and then it would be in accordance with the label indications. The specific reason for 17-pound weights is apparently at one of the research stations that does wildlife research, the heaviest weight that a raccoon could ever lift in a research setting was 17 pounds.
That is
so
one
that's
big
where
coon.
The magic number came from.
My God, man, wow. 17 pounds is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a deadlifting raccoon.
Goodness gracious! I'd be curious to see how the research project design was to figure that out.
I think it was down at Texas A&M Kingsville. Don't quote me on it, but I bet we could dig into the literature and figure it out.
Oh my God! I'm just picturing that.
That's the specifics behind it.
My goodness!
But yeah, ultimately the bait's got to be applied in a feeder that excludes access to everything but feral hogs. In that research project that AgriLife did, they ended up having to make some modifications to the feeders to make them work better. What happens is pigs get rough on them. They bend them up and they don't work as easily as they should. So they did things like insert grease in the sliding rails of the door. That took a little extra time to teach pigs how to open the gate or open the doors to it, because unlike a domesticated hog that's lived out of a feeder its whole life, they had to be trained how to open that up. That's part of the acclimation and the training process, is to have them eating out of the feeder while it's completely open and just eating corn. So that's your bait that you utilize to get them to learn how to come to the feeder and eat out of the self-feeding mechanism. Then after they've done that, you lower it halfway down and you put a little pin in there that it comes with. Then they have to, in order to get their head through the door, lift it up a little bit. But their nose can still fit. So they get accustomed to that weight and then the mechanism to slide the door up and down. And then once they're all dependent on corn on a daily basis, then you could close the door all the way and they'll figure out how to lift that door completely. And then none of the other animals, raccoons, possums, deer, dogs, coyotes, they'll be excluded at that point. And within that process, you've got to start introducing this bait because it's a different texture. And obviously it's coming out of a bucket or a bag, depending on how it's going to be accessed from the manufacturer. You start blending it in with your corn, and then, or with a placebo product that's not does not include the warfarin. Once they're eating that, and then you go to a higher percentage of the placebo bait, lower percentage of corn, until you eliminate all the corn. And after they eat that for a couple of days, and they're accustomed to the placebo bait, you clean all that out. You then replace that with a hot bait. And you got to keep that feeder full for about a week to 10 days, depending on the size and the number of pigs you've got coming through that feeder on a daily basis. And if you do it all right and you don't mess with the pigs during that process, they'll ultimately stop coming to the feeder. Then you can go out and start following buzzards and find out just how many pigs you killed.
Huh. Interesting. How so in that 10-day process, and I know this is one of the questions that you've gotten asked or has been asked 1,000 times. So what is it once what if the hog goes to the landowner, the neighboring landowner, and he shoots it while it's in that process and eats the hog?
The first thing that you're going to do is if you cut open a pig that's been consuming this bait, it includes a blue dye.
Interesting.
And I don't remember what it's called, but the studies out in Texas Tech showed that the product will turn the fat tissue, also all your adipose tissue, blue within 3 hours.
Now that is cool. I did not know that.
And within 24 hours, or maybe it's within 7 hours, something like that, you cut that pig open and it's going to look like a Smurf in the fat tissue.
Wow.
It is very bright and vivid. It's a really great idea that the company put into this product to prevent people from consuming a poisoned hog.
Yeah.
So that's the first fail safe. Mm-hmm. The second thing is if you're going to utilize this product, you might want to give your landowners
let your neighbors know.
Yeah. Yeah. Just say, heads up, I'm going to do us all a solid. And I'm going to try this product to get rid of the pigs. If you want a hog, well, we'll call the county agent. We'll find somebody that raises domestic ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. Yeah, buddy. And what is the name of that stuff?
Are you talking about the dye?
The actual product, Tracy, approved.
Oh, it's called Kaput Feral Hog Bait.
Oh, okay, it's Kaput, just like the gopher bait.
Yeah, so yeah, that's what I was kind of talking about earlier. So the Kaput is the product line name. So there's Kaput Groundhog, Kaput Feral Hog, Kaput Voles or Ground Squirrels, whatever you call it. You're getting into animals I'm not familiar with.
I did not realize that. I thought Kaput was just gophers and that was it. I guess because we never had any use for it around here for anything else.
Yep. So like I said, the company's out of Colorado, but they kill varmints and pests all over the country. And internationally, apparently. So the product's available. It started getting sold, trying to think off the top of my head. It would have been in April of 2024. Utilizing this stuff effectively is going to completely depend on what your goal is. And seasonality needs to play into it. So if I was a corn farmer and I've got a historic issue on a particular field with pigs tearing up my corn field, I'd be baiting them right now with corn to get them acclimated to a feeder. And I'm going to do that right now because I'm going to plant corn in Central Texas mid-February, late February. I'd like them to be dead before I put the corn in the ground.
Sure.
And so the timing that right now is the time to act. And that would tremendously reduce the impact that feral hogs will have on that particular field. You know, it's not for everybody with that in mind. You know, if you just want to shoot pigs and one at a time, that more power to you. And I would support that because that's a dead pig.
Yeah.
And hey, you want to trap a sounder, get the traps out and get after it. But if you want to do your best to kill all of them, it'll take you a month. But this product is shown to completely depopulate an area through the studies that A&M did.
It's a great tool for a toolbox, huh?
Yeah, like I said,
absolutely.
Depending on your property and your goals and mm-hmm. the size of your property, you know. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I can see if you're a row crop producer guy and you've got the land, you've got the, then yeah, you definitely want to go with a method like this, for sure.
Yeah, and you can tell me, Brad's the farmer here. Yeah, do the math. How many acres does it take
to get into
you?
Well, hey, speaking of that, what is a bucket of that cost?
So, you know, I think it has a minimum price of about $100 a bucket. And that's a 25-pound bucket. Now, I don't know what distributors are going to sell it because there's going to be a markup and a handling fee and stuff like that. But you just, in my opinion, I think you're going to get it around $100. A bucket. Now, the next question you get was, well, golly, how many pigs does that kill? Well, it'll kill a whole bunch of little pigs, and just kind of depends on the size and how much those pigs are eating per feeding before they die.
But so you just basically feed them until they stop coming, and when they stop coming,
you
know they're dead.
You self-feed them to death.
Yeah.
Yep. That is how it works. So, I mean, I kind of call it a passive control.
Yeah, bigger hogs are going to eat more. So.
Yeah, that's right, and they don't stop until they're done.
Mm-hmm.
So you may actually hit a lethal dose within a day or two, but since they're bigger pigs and they've got to, biologically it takes longer and more effort for them to succumb to the poison. You know, they may eat feed, they may eat bait that they didn't need, but they're still feeling good until they die. And that the Penn studies, and you talk about humane deaths and all of that. You know, they studied some of that in Mississippi or Alabama. And ultimately what the pigs do is they lay down, they get lethargic, and they die. know, that was one of the concerns from a humaneness standpoint, is that, you know, they'll squeal and, you know, there'll be blood, you know, spewing from their orifices. They did not see that in the pin studies. So, yeah.
And like and you said, this has been going on for 8 years already, Tracy, huh?
Yes. It's been challenging. But, you know, you get into the regulatory process and then just making products available for use for farmers and ranchers, it doesn't happen overnight. And it's something that we've been working on. And finally, in the last legislative session, got enough support to move the needle. And then obviously with help from farmers and ranchers, from the company that makes the product, and then to double check things from an effectiveness standpoint, AgriLife stepped in and did what the legislature asked them to do. And that was double check all the homework that the company did. Going through EPA through the normal regulated process.
Man, that's fantastic, Tracy. That's exactly what I've been like very curious about it for a year now, you know, trying to figure out where we are or what's going on.
You put it right, Brad. It's a tool. Or maybe Chancey said it is a great tool in the toolbox for somebody to use when you need it.
I said that, and, Tracy. I think don't give Chancey credit.
No. Well, I just like it because when I was messing with feral hogs, this was brand new. They were talking about, and I just didn't know all the details and where we were legislatively right now. So, yeah, man, you just a lot of good information.
Put it this way: I've got there are members of Texas Farm Bureau that I've stayed in contact with. That I've had tremendous success with it so far.
Fantastic.
Now it's got other than the effort and the finance, you know, side of, or economic side of it. The only other drawback I've seen is that, you know, since it takes 30 days for them to die, well, they're still tearing stuff up for 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
and I get that. Sure. I completely get it. Yeah. So that's just part of it.
And I mean, you'll have people that will try to rush the process and just skip the baiting part and go right to it. Probably
that's right. And they proved that with the studies. If you do that, it's a big waste of money.
Oh, okay.
Because you cannot skip any step that's on that label.
Yeah,
so
no,
that's
and
the
I,
worst
I,
thing you can do.
I would say this is just something like an absolute game changer for like a big producer.
Oh gosh, yeah. It's gonna change the ecological impact to areas in a dramatic way.
Because it's something we
better.
Yeah, because one of the things that we were talking about earlier, Tracy, is Jacob and I, when he and I first started working together, was working on a project down in Caldwell County. We're trying to get landowners on board to fly helicopters to kill hogs, you know, to show we were doing study on water quality. But
one of
the problems
Plum Creek,
was Plum Creek, that's exactly where it was.
Yep.
And one of the things that we couldn't do was we'd have landowners that had the pigs, but we couldn't access it. They didn't want us to kill them. But and especially our farmers, like the farmers down there were like, yes, you can have all my land, every bit of it, fly every bit of it. But there's right here on my neighbors. Get him. You got to get my neighbor. Well, guess what?
Got to get them because they're.
That's where they live. No. That's where they stay. That's where they're at in the daytime that you got to be flying helicopter in the daytime. And so this would give a tool to that landowner, that farmer, to deal with the problem that's coming from his neighbors that won't let him do it. So I just
it
see
absolutely
this.
Is.
When you say a tool in a toolbox and everything's got every specific tool, this is one that I definitely see a very useful place for particular situations.
Certainly.
Yeah, but man, that's exactly what we needed to know today, my friend. No, you gave us a wealth of information there, bud.
Well, glad to get the opportunity to visit with y'all. And if y'all ever think of something else, just feel free to give me a holler. Y'all continue the good work. Enjoy your podcast.
Hey, appreciate you, bud. Yeah, and it's sure good talking to you again, Tracy, and we'll keep in touch, bud.
Yeah, you too, Tracy. Hey, to everyone, I said hello, man, especially your dad.
We sure will. Hey, and Chancey, I still got some acorns for you.
Good. I need to go get those rice. That's the most impressive tree I've ever seen in my life.
Bet you if you stick them in the ground, they'll germinate.
But good. I dang sure tried. I need to go get them. Absolutely.
Y'all take care.
All right, bud. Good seeing you, Tracy. Well, thank you, Tracy, again. And, I mean, I guess, Chancey, that pretty much sums it up. You know, I mean, like mentioned a lot of the things there that a person has to use at your you know, at your disposal if you choose to use any of that to control hogs. And
yeah, and I mean, like I said, everybody, for every landowner, they have a different situation. And there's some other methods out there that we didn't, control methods that we didn't mention. You know, dogs are one of them. Snares are one of them. You know, there's cage, various kinds of traps, cage traps, you know, portable traps, there's the corral traps. Usually the bigger is the better. So depending on your financial status, how many pigs you have, how many acres you have, the problem that's getting it, are they, you know, what are they destroying? The crop that they're destroying, you know, are they destroying corn? Are they there seasonally? Are they in a pasture? That's all going to dictate what control method suits you best. And it's also what Jacob said, time. All this stuff is time consuming.
And, you know, I mean, I know with fly control and cattle, they talk about it a whole lot about an economic threshold.
Yes.
You know, you're never going to get rid of all the flies, but you need to get them down to an economic threshold. Well, it's just like the hog problem. I mean, me and you and your dog Flocko and Lacey, we would have never been able to control the hogs at the numbers that we had in the 90s to where they are today without all the things that we're now using. You know,
no.
that are at our hands to use. And so we hope you enjoyed that today. I mean, we got a little long, but we got a lot of good information from some good people who are knowledgeable on the subject.
Absolutely.
And we'll try to be a little more frequent, you know. Hopefully we get together soon and discuss another topic. But I guess that just about wraps this up, and we appreciate everybody for listening.
All righty. Good talking to you, Brad. Y'all all take care.
Have a good one, guys.